obviously the system is unsustainable. Any system that renders large numbers of people obsolete is not sustainable in the long run. I guess one thing I'd like to touch on is what is the role that women play into this? Because obviously, women have, they have higher standards. They expect a certain standard of living, and they're going to be less inclined to, women in general are going to be less inclined to want to live on some compound like that or live frugally.
Well, I don't know about that. I think one of the issues that white nationalists face is, of course, the fact that there are relatively few women involved in this. But even when you get women involved in it, you can't talk politics and do politics all the time. The women I do know who are involved in white nationalism or who are married to white nationalists are generally women who are very interested in a lot of these things. They're interested in micro farms and gardening and canning and preserves and getting as unplugged as possible from the cash economy through barter, all that kind of stuff. They're very concerned with these sorts of things. And I honestly think that it's quite appealing to a lot of women. One of the things that I constantly say about white nationalism is our goal is to restore the biological integrity of our race. And that doesn't just mean ending miscegenation and getting our population growing again, or at least stable rather than shrinking. It also has to involve the reassertion of the normative nature of heterosexual marriage and the normative nature of traditional and biological sex roles. And that means the idea of men as providers and fighters, if need be, and women as caregivers and nurturers. A lot of women want that. They want the opportunity to be housewives and mothers. And the present system, though, makes it prohibitively expensive to be a housewife and a mother. And I think that one of the things that we have to do is we have to explore ways that women can do this sort of stuff and be creative and intelligent about it. At the same time, as we need to work to create a system that makes affordable family formation and living on a single income and having it possible for wives to stay at home if they want to and be housewives and mothers, we need to focus on that. I think that's very good. One of our best authors is Julie Howard Hobson. She's no clinging vine, shrinking violet, sort of feminist stereotype of a housewife. She's no Stepford wife, okay? She's a really bright woman. She's creative. She's intelligent. She's outspoken. And she's also a housewife and a mother. And she is an incredibly intelligent, thrifty, innovative housewife and mother. I visited her, saw her place, her little micro farm, and all of her animals. And, she's, I think, a model of that highly intelligent, engaged way of living. And I think it's something that's very appealing to a lot of women. And so I think that one of the things that we're going to have to do as a subculture is we're going to have to evolve more than just political commitments, because you can't be talking politics all the time. It's really boring. There have to be elements of religion and art and community and just elements of living, right? How do you raise your kids? How do you garden? How do you keep a house? How do you do all of these things and insulate yourself and unplug yourself as much as possible from a hostile society? That's what we have to do. We have to evolve a whole tribal lifestyle. And that gives people something to do rather than just talk politics. It gives people outlets for their creativity and so forth. I think a lot of energy in the white nationalist milieu is just bottled up on the internet, posting comments and engaging in flame wars and things like that. A lot of that energy needs to go towards learning how to live off the grid, have barter economies, produce more of our own stuff, adopt voluntary simplicity, get out of the debt economy. There are ways that are being mapped out to do this, and I think that it's very, very important for us to get behind this. Again, if I could find a blogger who would deal with some of these sorts of issues, organic gardening and stuff like that. Somebody who would take the kind of stuff that John Robb is doing with his Sustainable Communities blog, which is a great resource, and apply it very explicitly and self-consciously to white nationalist issues. I think that would be a great
thing. But I guess the one thing is that there's not enough focus on economics. I mean, even among stuff in general, I mean, Countercurrents, I think, is doing a better job in comparison to other sites. But even among Countercurrents, I'd say it's something like maybe less than two. It's probably about 2 out of 10 articles in Countercurrents deal with economics. I think the economics is the big issue right now, because the reason this is happening is primarily because of the destruction, economic destruction of these people. If you look at race relations, for instance, I mean, I don't necessarily have a problem with other people. I get along with all kinds of people, and that's not really the issue. But the issue is that the current economy is not giving people the opportunities, and that's really the important thing to focus on.
I do think economics is very important. I think it's generous to say that 20% of our articles touch on economics. I think it's more like 2%.
Or maybe even less. Yeah, 2%.
Yeah, I would like to have an economics blogger who could write for us. One of our commentators wrote recently that he really wishes that I had somebody who could write more about social credit and other issues besides Ezra Pound, who's a bit hard to follow. And I'm the first to admit that Ezra Pound is pretty hard to follow. He was a poet. But you look at C.H. Douglas or Orridge or the other founders and promoters of social credit, they're hard to read too. But the ideas are very simple and powerful. So yeah, I would like to have an economics blogger, somebody who's a regular columnist. Again, if you are well-versed in third-way economics, if you are a good writer, if you want to communicate with 80 to 100,000 unique visitors a month, and you can do this on a regular basis and relate it to the whole raft of issues that Countercurrents deals with, I will give you a platform. That is a promise that I will make, and I want to find more people who can do this regularly on a weekly basis, if possible. That would be ideal.
And I know there's the website to distribute this review, but they're really focused on Catholicism. That's what it's. A lot of those websites, they're very tied to Catholicism, and that's sort of their niche.
Right, and Catholic social teachings are very, very healthy, and they're very good, and they're very similar to the kinds of things that I think white nationalists should be concerned about, and because they in some ways have common roots, because it's not just Catholicism. What's going on with Catholic social teaching is they have this idea of a hierarchical, organic society, and that's something that I think that white nationalists need to embrace as well, and that's what I push at Countercurrents. I say that I am a moral populist because I believe that no system is just unless it governs in the interests of all. There's something called the common good, and if you stray from that, your system becomes unjust. However, I believe that the best way of securing and promoting the common good is to have the best people in society rule. So you have to have a hierarchy. You have to have an elite, but the elite is not governing justly if they govern only for their own interests. They have to govern for the good of all. And that basic idea of the hierarchical, organic, normative model of society is the thing that guides Catholic social teachings and feeds into distributism, and I can embrace that wholly. Now, it's very interesting. If you look at the 19th century Folkish movement in Germany, you look at somebody like Nietzsche, for instance, who was not a friend of Christianity. You look at Nietzsche's most folkish pronouncements, and it's very clear that he is presupposing not some kind of ancient Greek model of a slave society or something like that. He is presupposing the medieval hierarchical, organic model of society as a norm. I think that's something that's very important, and that we need to make it explicit and embrace that as a standard of justice. And that helps us incorporate a lot of thought currents that don't necessarily belong to the new right or even would be hostile to it. But we can incorporate those things if we uphold that model, and then we can take from distributism, we can take from the folkish movement, we can learn a lot from Catholic social teachings. Salazar in Portugal, it was influenced by Catholic social teachings, and yet he was also a kind of fascist. A lot of third-way economics in predominantly Catholic countries was influenced by Catholic social teachings, and it has a great deal of value.
And distributism, I want to point out where there were two places where it was tried. One of them was the Basque region in Spain, and the other one was a region in northern Italy. And in both scenarios, those regions became very prosperous.
That's very interesting. I'd like to do more research on that. Years and years ago, I got very interested in cooperatives, and I read a bit about cooperatives in the Basque region, but I've forgotten all that, so it's something I need to go back to. Then I was sort of looking at it as a libertarian, and now I think I would look at it with much more favor.
And I noticed, I guess you touched on the issue of a hierarchy. I noticed there's sort of a tendency, there's a debate going on in the alternative right. You sort of have social Darwinist on one side, but if you've been listening to sort of a lot of the Andy Nowicki's article, Andy Nowicki's sort of taking the opposite stance of a social Darwinist to a degree of sort of a lot of his articles are about kind of compassion for people who are kind of, in a sense, kind of like total losers. What's your take on that, the debate about social Darwinism?
Well, I hate social Darwinism, frankly. I think it's an immoral ideology. The new right, as I define it, repudiates social Darwinism.
Generally, the people in the alternative right, they're kind of a bunch of introverted, kind of nerdy intellectual types who would be totally screwed under social Darwinism, yet they all write in their blogs that they support social Darwinism.
Exactly. If they support social Darwinism, then they support having sand kicked in their face on the beach by jocks. I mean, that's what social Darwinism boils down to. It basically is might makes right, and I don't think that's true. I think that a lot of the problems that our race faces today has been the implicit adoption of social Darwinist attitudes. You don't have empire building without a bit of social Darwinism. I mean, sometimes they would salve their consciences by saying they were doing it for Christ or the good of the people that they were conquering. But most of it just boils down to these people have land and resources and we want to steal them. If we can get away with it, all well and good. And that's gotten us into a lot of trouble. It worked swimmingly well when we were actually conquering them. And since then, they've been conquering us. And if might makes right isn't the situation that we're in today, right? I mean, we are the losers of history right now as a race, you know, and not just losers in the social, you know, the high school hierarchy, the social hierarchy sense, right? We're the losers of history. If might makes right, then this is the right situation, unless we can change it, right? I think that might makes right is a dumb idea, honestly. It's a dumb idea. I think that there are moral standards over and above just pure force. And I think that we have to acknowledge that. I think I'm a kind of Platonist. If you want to deal with the argument that might makes right, read the first book of Plato's Republic, where Socrates mops that argument up and disposes of it. So I think there are objective moral criteria, and it doesn't necessarily follow that who's ever the strongest is the right, is in the right. So anyway, I'm not a social Darwinist. I think it's an antiquated ideology. It's a 19th century ideology. It's ideology of the ancient sophists. And it's the implicit ideology of a lot of people who have freighted our race down with a great deal of historical crimes and disadvantages today. So, yeah, I think that That's not a good thing.
And if you look at American history, a lot of that mentality really goes back to like the 19th century, when basically the Europeans came in and they stole all the land from the Indians and they slaughtered all the Indians and then they basically came in and raped. Maybe I'm sounding a little bit like a leftist, but it's true. And they raped the natural resources. And America was kind of founded on that mentality. But today we have this sort of facade of egalitarianism and political correctness. But deep down, America is still this like social Darwinist society that we had in the 19th century when the white man came in and like slaughtered all the Indians. It's still that strain is still there in American society.
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, there are a lot of people that I would basically call sociopaths who are very politically correct and lovey-dovey. They're highly hypocritical and deceptive, deceitful people. Yet when you get right down to it, a lot of them are only concerned with winning, and by winning that means getting more, and they have no real connection to any other people, certainly not to their nation or their race. They're powerful sociopaths, and there's a lot of that.
Do you know the blogger Robert Lindsay, the liberal race realist? He has an interesting article a while from about 6 months ago. It's called "One of the Biggest Myths in American Society is that the smarter you are, the wealthy." The biggest myth: the smarter you are, the richer you are. Is one of the biggest myths in our society. And he's a leftist, but he's always talking about how he has this really high IQ of 150, yet he's totally broke.
I don't think it's entirely a myth, but I think that intelligence is not enough. The people who tend to be rich are intelligent. I'm sure that, you know, Mitt Romney has a very high IQ. Okay, I'm sure he does. Yet there are other things that need to go along with that to get rich. One is that you have to be somewhat extroverted and psychologically uncomplicated, because otherwise you'll be one of these introverted people with a high IQ who's always questioning himself.
Those types of people are vastly overrepresented in this movement.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But the people who are rich in America tend to be highly intelligent, but they tend to be extroverted, psychologically uncomplicated, and I would also say that they tend to be sociopathic, or they tend to cluster in the direction of sociopathy when you do some sort of personality inventory. Otherwise, they're too bogged down by human attachments that get in the way of their rise to the top. And so I honestly think that that's part of it. Another thing that I think is a characteristic of people who are highly successful in this society is an astonishing amount of dishonesty. And I don't just mean telling little white lies, but I mean living lies all the time. You know, marrying somebody and never actually showing your true face to your own spouse or your own family. That happens a lot. I've known people like that. I haven't known them really, but let's say I've known their spouses and children, and I've seen people like this, and they're kind of chilling. The level of systemic dishonesty, masks with masks on top of masks, you know, that kind of thing, is really astonishing. But these people are often highly successful because of that. They can be whoever they need to be to rise. And we obviously need a different way of choosing people for wealth and power in our society. You cannot have a healthy society where basically the way to the top is through sociopathy, manipulation, lack of emotional depth, lack of connection. These are not the traits of the sort of people you want to run the society. These are the sort of traits, though, that are creating the hell that we have today.
That's true, but it's been like that throughout history.
It's getting worse, though.
It's getting even worse. So how do you put a limitation on those kinds of people? How do you do that?
Well, I talked to Willis Cardo once, and he said that, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s, the Chamber of Commerce was a hotbed of rabid American patriotism. I mean, these people actually thought in terms of what was good for America. And this was the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, they might have thought, you know, highly conveniently that the business of America was business, right? But the attitudes of people in business have dramatically shifted in the last 50 years. They might not have been all that good in terms of their patriotism 50 years ago or 60 years ago, but they were still patriotic. They don't make any pretense of that today. Right? So things have dramatically shifted in terms of the attitudes of the business class. I think that's just part of a cultural shift. What do you do to rein it in? Well, basically, you just have to create rules for business. You have to say, look, if you want to sell things to Americans, you have to build it in America, right? You institute protectionism. Protectionism didn't prevent people from getting really rich in America in the past. But beyond that, you can't just have a business elite of sociopaths who have to deal with protectionist measures. I mean, you don't want that. I mean, ultimately what you need is you need a culture and an educational system that imbues people with patriotism, thinking about their race and so forth. And beyond that, you need a way of weeding out sociopaths and preventing them from getting in any kind of positions of power. And
I would say that the American education system does a worse job at that. I think if you compare, I've talked to people who have gone to school in say Europe or Asia. I think education in Europe and Asia is not quite as bad when it comes to how it encourages people like that.
I would probably think that's true. In America, the whole cash nexus system, capitalist system, right, rewards people for being duplicitous, calculating, and heartless. That's how you get ahead. That's how you outcompete people. If you can't get into positions of power and influence, or if you can get into positions of power and influence that way, you will. So what do you do to try and prevent people from getting into positions of power and influence who have those personality defects? Well, let's just say that there can be sorting mechanisms, I think, in education that prevent people like that from getting ahead. These people aren't highly functional across the whole spectrum of human relations. They typically have failed marriages, horrible family lives, and things like that. I mean, they're not perfect actors, right? They tend to have a lot of problems in life, but it's the narrowness of the business world and the narrowness of the criteria that allow for success that allow these people to rise to the top. So what you do is you try and have a culture that requires excellence across the whole spectrum of human relations before anybody can get ahead. How do you do that? Well, one of the things I think you should probably do is institute requirements of national or military service. Because I think that, you know, in situations like that, if anybody's ambitious, they have to, you know, give 2 years of national service or something like that, you're just going to find that the sociopaths are not good at that kind of stuff. They can't actually function in ways like that. That would be my hope. They lack the natural human warmth and things like that that are required for, say, real bonding in a military unit or real camaraderie or real concern for other people. And so I think that maybe there'd be ways of weeding people like that out. Eventually, we can find ways of just weeding them out of the gene pool entirely. But I think that you, if you erect selection mechanisms, you simply have an attitude that was widespread in the past, that you looked into people's personal lives. You know, if somebody had a record of divorces or wife beating or cruelty to animals or things like that, in the past, these people were shunned. They were frozen out of society. Today, people look at this, if they learn about it, if they're curious enough to learn about it, they look at it and say, well, you know, but yeah, he's a really good lawyer, so who cares? I really do think that we have to find ways of weeding out the Patrick Bateman types. And I thought American Psycho was a distasteful movie, but it really illustrated how there is this... It was a fanciful and memorable portrait of a sociopath who was upwardly mobile. And, of course, one of the things that was so funny about Patrick Bateman's character is how politically correct he was in a lot of his
pronouncements. Yeah, I mean, I've seen the movie. You remember the scene. I've not read the book. The book's a little different.
I haven't read it either.
But I have seen the movie. I remember that scene where he's at a cocktail party in New York City, and he's saying you can tell he genuinely doesn't care about this, but he's giving lip service. Oh, what's going on in South Africa is so horrible and racist, and like the starvation in Africa. Like he's just, it's kind of, I think, who is it? But it's, yeah, that's basically where he's just pretending to give lip service to that.
Yeah, well, those are the people who rule us today. I think a lot of them are just heartless sociopaths who are paying lip service to the idols of today. That's the coin of the realm, and they want to have a lot of coins in their pockets, so that's how they act. But deep down inside, I think they're as sociopathic as a Cecil Rhodes. They just have a different set of morals today, or they feign a different
Cecil Rhodes is obviously like a big white supremacist, but it's the same type of person.
Right. Cecil Rhodes was a big white supremacist because that's what it took for him to become a powerful person. When the fellow white people of South Africa, the Boers, got in his way, well, he didn't have any feelings of white solidarity for them. You know, so that's the kind of person I think that we're dealing with in America today and in most of the Western world. Cold and sociopathic, they ultimately believe that might makes right because morality doesn't mean anything to them. But because they're such practiced deceivers and because they want to rise, they will use the moral coin that's current today, namely the politically correct anti-white morality, to rise to the top. Now, there are other people involved in this who are entirely idealistic, I would think. And I think that Jews, who are generally pushing this, they have a strand of racial idealism to what they do. They're not just out for themselves.
There's sort of stereotypical caricature that they're all evil and conspiratorial, but that isn't true. I mean, they genuinely believe what they're doing is the right thing.
I think a lot of them believe that what they're doing is the right thing, but their standards of what's right are inimical to the interests of other people. So, you know, it's both. In a way, from my point of view, what they're doing is scheming and sociopathic, and from their point of view, they're looking out for their own kind at the expense of other people, and that is their code of ethics, unfortunately.
But the thing is, most people, they're just conformists. They don't think through. They don't really take a time to think things through. They're just conformists, and they go with what's the dominant ideology. I mean, there's the intellectuals, but in general, that's basically how most people are.
Most people are conformists, and most people today, most white people today, unfortunately, are conforming to standards of conduct that are engineered for our destruction. And that's what we have to fight. We have to explain that to them.
So I think we've got enough material in. So, Greg, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this.
And that's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.